This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning into Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Jessica Page Schuyfield will speak with us about fracking in the Flint Hills and a direct action planned for Topeka on Thursday. But first, I'm naturally with your headline news. ENN.com reports the significant scale of human impact on our planet has changed the course of Earth history. An international team of scientists led by the School of Geography, Geology, and the Environment has suggested. The researchers suggest that a multitude of human impacts have changed the course of Earth's geological history, and the scale of these justifies developing a formal proposal that the Anthropocene, a concept improvised by the Nobel Prize-winning scientist Paul Crutzen in 2000, should be made part of the geological time scale. Rapid changes to the planet include acceleration of rates of erosion and sedimentation, large-scale chemical perturbations to the cycles of carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and other elements, the inception of significant change to global climate and sea level, and biotic changes, including unprecedented levels of species invasions across the Earth. A week after Hurricane Maria rolled through Puerto Rico, the island faces a public health crisis with no power and a growing shortage of drinking water and food. The majority of the island's 69 hospitals are without electricity or fuel for generators, according to the U.S. Department of Defense, and at least two people have died in an intensive care unit after it ran out of diesel. In many places, there's no water to drink or bathe in or to flush toilets, with residents forced to use rainwater. U.S. Customs and Border Protection says a plane carrying 3,500 pounds of water, ready to eat Army meals, diapers, and other supplies, is on its way. Quote, "This is a disaster of major proportions," says Brian Swartz, interim vice president, science and health protection for the Public Health Ontario, who is also an associate professor in the Faculty of Medicine and the Dalhousie Lana School of Public Health. DemocracyNow.org reports, in Peru, members of indigenous Achuar communities say they have seized control of at least 50 oil wells operated by the Canadian company Frontera Energy Corporation in the Amazon. They say they took over the wells, as well as an electric plant and oil tanks, to protest the Peruvian government's failure to consult them about the extraction projects. They also said in a statement, quote, "We have been living with oil pollution for 45 years, caused by the irresponsibility of the companies and the state. For decades, we have seen that our waters, soils, and resources are damaged with impunity," end quote. EcoWatch.com reports Tyson Foods, the nation's largest chicken producer, has taken full responsibility for accidentally releasing an acidic chemical used in chicken feed into the city of Monett, Missouri's wastewater treatment system that resulted in the deaths of more than 100,000 fish. The poultry giant pleaded guilty on Wednesday in federal court in Springfield, Missouri, on two criminal charges of violating the Clean Water Act that stemmed from discharges at its slaughter and processing facility in Monett, Missouri, and the U.S. Department of Justice said, The Arkansas-based company issued a statement taking responsibility of the 2014 incident. According to the DOJ, one of the ingredients Tyson used in its chicken feed is a liquid food supplement called Alimet, which has a pH level of less than 1. A tank that stored the chemical leaked and flowed into the containment area. The company then hired a contractor to remove the substance and take it to the Monett plant. However, the in-house treatment system was not designed to treat the substance. From there, the acidic chemical released into Monett's municipal wastewater treatment plant and killed bacteria used to reduce ammonia and discharges from the treatment plant into a nearby creek, resulting in the death of approximately 108,000 fish. Tyson will have to pay a $2 million criminal fine and serve 2 years of probation, the DOJ said. The company must also pay $500,000 to maintain and restore waters in the Monett area, with a focus on Clear Creek and the adjoining waterways. At this time, that's all for the news, and I'm going to ask Mr. Mike Murphy to take over.
Thank you, Natural E, and I appreciate the news there. So back in August 14th, to be specific, we had some folks on from a group called Flint Hills Stewards. We had Alexa Dawson and Carla Jo Grimmett on talking about the proposed high-pressure injection of wastewater into the Flint Hills. That wastewater comes from fracking in other locations. And so we had those folks on and what they were trying to do to stop that. And subsequently, the Kansas Corporation Commission held a hearing shortly after that program, but did not issue a ruling until last week. And so we have on the phone with us, we have Jessica Skyfield, a concerned citizen who's very concerned about this issue. And here in the studio, we also have a couple of folks. We have Bob Hopman, and I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
Mary Benrud.
And Mary Benrud and Bob Hopman and Jessica. So, Jessica, let's start with you. So tell us about what this case was about and the ruling, and take it from there.
Okay. So, as you said, the Flint Hills stewards had been fighting an application by Quail Oil. They submitted it in about January this year to operate a high-pressure, high-volume underground injection well that to dispose of chemical-laced salt water, basically, in the Flint Hills. The ruling was the 21st of September, and the Kansas Corporation Commission ruled in favor of Quail. They're allowed to now start operating that well. They're permitted now. The original petitioners could refile a petition within 15 days of the ruling. That would be October 6th. Is my understanding that they do not plan to do so. I think that this particular well does pose maybe not, I could go ahead and say more of a threat given the information that I've been gathering geologically. I have a minor in geology, so I'm not an expert, but neither was the Quail Oil guy. Anyway, the Kansas Corporation Commission is a governor-appointed three-member commission whose mission is to, I'm going to read it, serve the people of Kansas by regulating the state's energy infrastructure, oil and gas production, and commercial trucking to ensure public safety. So the energy infrastructure is this well, and to ensure public safety, that's in the same sentence. However, in this instance, it doesn't seem that due diligence was done in order to establish that this particular well would be, you know, fine with public safety for water resources or increased what are called induced or man-made earthquakes. So.
Okay. And so the people, the original petitioners, the people I guess we referred to as the Flint Hills stewards, mm-hmm. as your understanding is they're choosing not to appeal this.
Correct.
Okay.
I mean, they may, I'm having fingers crossed that they're going to change their mind, but I doubt it. So I was going through some of the Kansas statutes, and I've found one that allows people that weren't the original petitioners to request judicial review or a rehearing, which that's the angle I'm going to explore now, specifically to get this well stopped. Like, I actually have I'm not pleased with this well. I'd like to get the whole process changed as well. And so I'm kind of looking at this as the tipping point for this issue in Kansas. I mean, I know there have been people fighting the oil and gas industry in Kansas since it began. I mean, in earnest, I guess, that was like the 50s through 70s, but, you know, it existed in a looser form before then. But I'm thinking, you know, this would be this well, it seems particularly dangerous because it's located on a fault line. It's close to sensitive groundwater areas. Those two reasons alone, to me, are enough to be concerned about this particular one and want to fight this one and use it to kind of springboard off to change the way these laws are created. I mean, in the executive branch of government, these three people were appointed by the governor, who happened to be Governor Brownback. But one of them, I've heard, I haven't actually investigated, it could be easy to do, I just haven't had time. One of them changed their political party because of the three people on the commission, they can't all be of the same party. So they were all originally Republicans, and then somebody changed to an unaffiliated. Again, I haven't verified that, I've just been told that.
Where they're going to inject this wastewater from fracking? I have a couple questions about that. One,
sure.
So I'm presuming that's on someone's land who's already agreed to it. They just needed.
I'm in the rabbit hole with this. This is all kind of new information for me. The permit Quail's application has unleased and leased mineral rights owners listed on it. So I'm not sure how. I mean, I've tried to look it up as far as what the difference between leased and unleased mineral rights and the landowners and stuff. But it seems like it's a different type of permit. I mean, that's all just mineral rights. And so if they could have not leased their mineral rights, but they could have leased their land, like the top of it, basically, you know, even though it's a well. I'm not exactly sure on all of that.
Because this, we're not talking about extraction here. We're talking about just the opposite, injection.
Correct.
Right. Which leads me to my other question about this. So, what is being injected or proposed by Quail to be injected into this land is wastewater from a fracking operation somewhere else. Do you know anything about where that fracking operation is?
It's nearby. That's the whole impetus for it being where they've asked it to be, is that the fracking itself is quite nearby. So rather than them having to truck out their fracking waste, they can just, you know, inject it into this well in the Flint Hills.
Understood. Whatever this is that's being injected, it's kind of proprietary, exactly what's in there. Do we know exactly the contents of what's being injected?
I mean, they talk a lot about, the salt water is not going to be higher than 5,000 parts per thousand, 5,000 ppt, but I mean, so yeah, for salt water, that is pretty low. But what else is in there? Yeah, I mean, they don't try to advertise that. That's something I could try to find specifically out. And actually, I do have a resource on that I could ask specifically. She used to work in that industry, and she'd be willing to, I'm sure, share some of that stuff with me. I can ask her.
That's good to know. So I want to bring in the folks here in the on-air studio. What do you folks want to add to what's been said so far?
The Kansas Corporation Commission was originally Utilities Commission. It was established in the late 1800s. It's Kansas has one of the oldest established utility commissions in America. In different states, it's called something different. We know them in Missouri as the Missouri, Utilities Commission.
Public Utilities.
Right,
yeah.
Public Utilities.
PUC, yeah.
In Texas, it's the Texas Railroad Commission. And this is a commission that is established by law. And they abide by the statutes that have been written over 100 years and updated as industry has progressed. By corporations to support primarily the extractive industries. They also regulate our electricity rates and things of that nature. And it is a fact that the commissioners are put in place by the governor. But the Kansas Corporation Commission itself is a fairly large body. I think they have an $18 million annual budget. The commissioners themselves earn about $125,000 a year, the same as an appeals judge on the Kansas Supreme Court. The commissioner earns something a little bit higher than that. So this is a body that is deeply embedded within Kansas law. And the rules under which, and the laws under which they approved this fracking well are heavily stacked in favor of the oil and gas industry. And this is actually why the original petitioners, or protestants, as they're called, have decided not to appeal, because the laws are not in their favor right now. And their thinking is they need to change the law. There's a whole other movement afoot, however, because we understand that citizens are cut out of the process entirely, legislatively, legally. There's no real avenue for redress. And so there are movements to have communities establish their own community rights and, you know, work outside of that system by creating their own system. Mary, you might chime in.
Yeah, I'm like taking in the information because we've been thinking about this, trying to like in an orderly way something that's valuable to the conversation. I mean, one of the things that's notable about this whole process is that, you know, it's counterintuitive. It seems like, you know, the evidence is so obvious that there's some scientific information that just wasn't included. And, you know, I'm coming at this after fighting the pipeline, and I've been working on stopping Line 3 up north and have been dealing with public utility commissions all over the place. And there is some inherent problems with the process where literally the laws and the regulatory structures that have been set up have almost impassable bias towards having this stuff passed. And it's very difficult and very expensive to be able to inject some sanity and science into the process. There's nuanced statements about there has to be imminent proof that there's some harm. Well, essentially, the reading of it in Kansas is that unless somehow you could time travel and prove that putting the well in or disposing the water in this way, unless you can prove beyond a doubt that it's going to cause harm, they are going to pass it. And so, you know, it's just this circular thing. So that one more piece of science doesn't fit into the structure is so jaded that even well-documented information in comparable areas is not being allowed to affect their decision-making. Because they're literally saying that if this well and this site cannot, beyond all doubt, be proven to cause some kind of harm, then we are going to approve this well. Mm. And so, you know, I have my seatbelt buckled on. This is, you know, I've said this before, but I was up at Standing Rock. I've been up trying to stop Line 3. I've been working on water issues for a while. You know, these systems that we believe in, that good people believe in, that if we just have that one piece of information, we can convince these people that somehow they're well-meaning and somehow it will tip the scale. At this point, I just think that there's a shift for me, that I claim my right and my children's right and my grandchildren's right to have clean water. And that it's an inherent right, and that I'm working with a larger perspective that goes on as long as it can. And I'm very interested in supporting what goes on with this well, and that's for people above my pay grade to find out if there is some way to find the right, you know, piece of wood you can pull out and make this tower fall down and, you know, some sanity can be injected. But, you know, coming at it from a perspective of mobilizing people to say what they believe in, to inject, like, some basic fundamental human, you know, understanding of the right for water into this process.
Okay, so clean water is obviously an issue with regard to this, but what about... is there concern about earthquakes? I mean, I know there's earthquakes have increased in Kansas and Oklahoma as a result of fracking, but does the injection part as well? Do we know if that, Jessica or Bob, maybe?
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, definitely. So basically, think about this. Like, you have a fault line, so it's two basically pieces of the earth that are rocks put together. You lubricate that, it's going to move. I mean,
yeah.
That's how it works, so...
It's not the fracking that's causing the earthquakes. It is the injection of the fracked wastewater at high pressure volumes that has caused the earthquakes. So
really?
There are other methods of extracting oil that also produce wastewater that needs to be disposed of. So it's not just fracked wastewater. The issue, as far as earthquakes is concerned, is the high-pressure injection of fluids deep into the earth, and they happen to be going into sensitive areas, into these faults. In Kansas, the Kansas Corporation Commission, at Sam Brownback's recommendation, explored the increase in earthquakes in Kansas in 2010, 11, and 12. And the Kansas Corporation Commission actually put into place in two specific wells in southern Kansas a reduction in the volume of wastewater that can be injected, citing the Kansas Geological Survey, Oklahoma Geological Survey, and U.S. Geological Survey that that conclusively proved that injection wells do induce earthquakes. And so it's not as if the Kansas Corporation Commission is unaware of that. They're very aware of that, and those rules remain in place. There is a reduction right now in those two wells in southern Kansas, and they continue to explore it. And in fact, earthquakes, the number of earthquakes has gone down. But according to the Kansas Corporation Commission, there have also been fewer wells in that same time period of the study. And so they won't conclusively say that it's the reduction in the injection of the volume of water. It could be because of the number of wells. And so at any time, they can lift that restriction and go back up to, 15 or 16,000 barrels a day. I think now the restriction is 8,000 barrels. And in their ruling, they specifically cited that this well only has 5,000 gallons per day, barrels per day. And so it's well below the established parameter for those wells down south. And by the way, those wells down south have a different geological formation. And as Mary said earlier, they were unable to conclusively prove that this formation is going to be in danger of getting earthquakes. And it's, as Mary said, get a time machine, go into the future, watch it happen, and then, you were right. But
I've read the testimony of all the expert witnesses from the trial and everything like that, and Dr. Aber, for the petitioners, did a great job with his case, and it fell on deaf ears for the most part. And then the gentleman for Quail Oil that had less experience, less knowledge, less high degree, they just kind of were like, okay, we're going to believe this guy over this other guy. And so, but there's still a lot more data. There's a study out of Stanford on this particular formation of the Arbuckle Shale in this area. I mean, it's not the same exact geologic coordinates, but it's the same formation, saying that, it would be a real tragedy to go ahead and operate any underground injector wells in this area.
Yeah.
And, that evidence wasn't, he didn't maybe know about that study because there's always new studies coming out and stuff like that. And so that was like a resource that exists that's, known in the scientific community that wasn't inputted into the hearing at all. That should probably be considered.
And you're right. I was actually at that hearing, and Dr. Aber for the protestants was asked directly, will there be an earthquake from this injection well? Can you definitively say there will be an earthquake? And he said no. And it could be, as Jessica said, because he wasn't privy to any surveys in that specific spot. And that's certainly possible. And we know the Arbuckle fault has is a location of many, many earthquakes.
So the original protestants have decided, okay, well, it looks like they've got us with the law. What we need to work on now is changing the law. But you folks have different ideas about so what do you have planned?
I specifically started a Facebook group called Kansas Water, and we're working. There's a woman in Topeka, and you probably should call her. I just spoke with her, and she's fine with you calling her later. Jo Charay, and she is kind of part of, like Mary is, the national groups that have been fighting the oil and gas industry in various capacities in our country. So she's plugged into that, those kind of mobilizing type people, and we're going to have a nonviolent direct action at the KCC offices in Topeka at 4 p.m. on this Thursday, so October 5th. So that's, I mean, but obviously that, it's not like, oh, we can plan this one event and everything's going to get fixed. But I think drawing public attention to this particular situation is beneficial, because the more public awareness we create, I mean, the thing is, these things happen throughout our state, and people in the larger city centers never get to hear about it because they're just publicized in the small newspapers and whatnot for that particular area. I mean, when they apply for these, the permits for these wells, it'll usually be in like a, the tiniest little text in the bottom of like the, I don't know, Hutchinson Gazette. And, you know, not everybody's even going to see that. And then the process gets started with KCC, and then it gets permitted, and nobody even really found out about it. We have public support behind this one. KCUR did a piece. You know, people in Kansas City were able to hear about it. Flint Hill Steward's already been working super hard on this. The public is mobilized, so that event is just to capture that and let them know, like, hey, we're watching you. Hey, we're concerned about this. And then, you know, there's also obviously other prongs to the fork where we're talking with our legislators and trying to get new laws written. And if I would like to get this, the whole, sorry, my whole problem with this is the fact that this is an executive branch of government that is adjudicating cases for the public, which that's messed up. That's not how government works. So obviously, can't, you know, the EPA's regulations on how states basically legislate this kind of stuff, it's state by state. So there's, we have a lot less lax, we have less stringent laws than other states, and I would like to get that fixed in Kansas. And I think using this case can start doing that. Like, because Bob's saying there's a huge, you know, undercurrent of a long-term solution happening where it's a movement that's going to have to be built step by step. But I think drawing the public's attention to the fact that we don't have a voice in this at all, and this is our actual public safety, water quality at stake, I mean, we need to really get on this.
So does KDHE not have a dog in this fight?
No. I was looking into that because, but they, I mean, I would think they have to. I mean, that is an angle that I was wanting to explore more. And maybe Bob, you, or Mary, you could speak to that. I haven't seen it from the digging I've done.
No, I've heard nothing about any other state agencies involved. I have heard about some nonprofits who have been involved in various consultations, but and they're working long term to change the laws. Which I think in the long term, I think it's not just about changing the laws. It's about establishing our rights as human beings, as a community, to clean water, to not non-destruction of the earth and the air. And it's challenging the very fundamental systems in play.
Also, I think some of the issues around the potential for earthquakes were addressed. But there is a federal exemption for fracking that keeps water issues out of it. The Halliburton loophole. So the water safety issues are exempted. And there has been, I was down in Oklahoma when was I down there, Bob? Like in March. When Erin Brockovich was there with her legal team. And essentially their advice to me in Kansas was tell people to start taking pictures of their structures and documenting tremors. And we'll be heading up your way next.
Wow. That's incredible. Folks, if anyone has any questions or comments, you can join in the conversation. The number is 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-5534. This is an interesting discussion.
To answer your question, I was looking up at the KDEH site, and I think what happens is their role in it is after the fact. So if there's a documented problem from the well regarding water quality or some other issue, that's when they step in. So they're not part of the permitting agency or part of the granting agency, and that's part of the problem is that the KCC has basically complete control over this process, and it's three people that the governor appoints.
So maybe that's what it stands for, Kansas Complete Control.
Right. It's ridiculous.
Wow. That's fascinating. Again, the number to call is 816-931-5534. So you were concerned at all about what they used to refer to they used to refer to as the domino effect, that if this goes, then it's just going to lead to more and more?
I mean, I'm kind of looking at it like that. I mean, I know that that's coming from, like, a really idealistic perspective here, but, I mean, yeah, it's got to start somewhere. I mean, when is it going to be? It's 2 years down the road, however long the legislative process will take, or can, you know, this be the domino you speak of or the tipping point or whatever? I'd like to think so. I mean, this well in and of itself, in my opinion, is pretty dangerous. And yeah, I'm afraid if they get this one passed, they'll just be like, see, this one's fine. This one's just fine. So we can just keep doing this. No problem, right? It's like if, you know, stop this one so that doesn't happen.
The global anti-fracking movement is on fire. And there's people all over the place, people that have been it more entrenched than we have in particular, been kind of watching it here. Bob and I set up an organization called the
Water Protection Mobilization.
Water Protection Mobilization, so that when people get to this point where they want to make some moves beyond public awareness, that there's some ideas about how we can transition together to do this long term. And we also have reached out to some of our friends in East Boulder who successfully passed a moratorium, a 10-year moratorium in their state. And they are facing a new battle with multiple wells potentially coming in really quickly. They also have been dealing with water issues, and they have based their model, their long-term model of staying intact and the successes they have on this group called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. So right now we are reaching out. We've been reaching out to some people in the UK. We're reaching out to our friends in Boulder. We're trying to get some more training in, and we support Jessica and everybody else that's doing this, and we're trying to do the long-term strategizing and the cultural shift that we think that all this stuff is going to take. We're up against some pretty big opponents, and they're smart, and they have a lot
of
resources.
Money.
Well, and like I said, I was up at Standing Rock kind of firsthand, arrested up there with that, all the militarization of their protection of that one little pipeline. And, this country sees these issues as national security issues, and we, in a steady way, working with each other to exchange information, to support each other in a variety of ways of addressing this, we need to stay connected, and we invite everybody to participate. And Jessica's got, Kansas Water is your site,
mm-hmm.
Jessica? And we have the Water Protection Mobilization site.
So I have a question about what happens, are there benchmark readings being done? Is there testing being done on the ground by the site now so that we could say, hey, here's what the water quality was like here, you know, before you guys started. And so a year from now, you can actually point to some difference or not. Or has any even thought been given into that, what we're doing to do readings on the ground there?
I mean, all that, like I said, all those things, you know, and this kind of like semi-sleep state we're waking up from, all those things seem like there must be some little magical elves dressed in regulators suit that say water is life, that run around and check water all over the place. As far as we know, that's not being done. I mean, also, when we've been reading through this...
But I mean, I'm not asking for the state, waiting for the state to
right.
do it, like... involving K-State or, you know, so, or some extension
yeah.
or something like that. And it seems like that might be a good... I don't know who to ask. KDH,
well,
I don't know.
That would be a question for the folks in Flint Hills, I guess. And it's a good question to ask them. I do know that, you know, challenging the well in terms of how it will affect the water was something they wanted to do. However, it cost additional money. They would have had to hire additional experts to do that. And so they challenged based on the earthquakes. That was a choice they made based on monetary resources available to
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that in many places where fracking has been going on for years, including Pennsylvania and Ohio, where there is poisoning of the water, the oil companies say, well, it's not us. And it's really hard to prove that it is them because there are some naturally occurring chemicals, including nuclear, and it is very difficult to prove, especially when the laws are stacked against.
I mean, isn't there – they don't have to expose what chemicals they use in the process.
That's
I mean,
also
that's
right.
the other issue. I mean, some people have come up with lists that there's hundreds of them. Many of them, you know, there isn't even knowledge of what small percentage causes what damage. So there's all kinds of holes in trying to monitor this and figure that stuff out. But
companies like Quail Oil consider that proprietary information.
Mm-hmm.
And the laws protect them from sharing
from public
that.
Disclosure of it.
Mm-hmm.
Jessica, are you okay? You know you've got family things, so I don't know. Can you still stay with us on the line?
Yeah, I can. Or, you know, you can call Joe, too. I'm fine, though. I'm fine.
No, okay. All right, so I want to, just in case people are tuning in, remind our listeners again about what you've got planned for Thursday.
Okay, so Thursday... bunch of folks. I'm actually thinking there's a Facebook page, Kansas Water. There's an event on there called Quail Oil Has No Right to Our Land. You can go there, find out some details. You could RSVP on Facebook, but I think Joe is working on a lot of different channels like Twitter, and she's plugged into some, I don't even know, groups to get social media stuff out. So I think it's actually going to end up turning into kind of a large gathering of people, which is going to be exciting to really show them, hey, this is not, we're not okay with this anymore. Please stop. So we're going to be meeting at the KCC offices in Topeka. I could look up an address for people, I guess, but it's at 4 p.m. on Thursday, October 5th.
It's 1500 Southwest Arrowhead Road.
Yes, there you go. Perfect.
Yeah. Okay. We are going to take our one break now, and maybe what I'll try and do, Jessica, is get Joe on the other line while we're taking that break, and if you can stay on, that's great.
Okay.
All right, we'll do that. Again, you are listening to Eco Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. We'll be back after this.
On this week's All Souls Forum, Dr. Tech Sample will discuss the white working class, a group that ever since the presidential election has come increasingly into the media spotlight. Why did they paradoxically elect a non-working class billionaire to champion their challenges and misfortunes? Why do progressives who fight many of the same battles seem clueless about how to relate to this group of Americans? Listen to All Souls Forum this Wednesday at 6 p.m. to find out, here on 90.1 FM KKFI.
UMKC is hosting renowned environmentalist author Bill McKibben on October 6th at Pearson Auditorium. The title of his talk is The Hottest Fight in the Hottest Decade, and it begins at 6 p.m., free and open to the public. Seating is limited. RSVP at go.umkc.edu/McKibben, M-C-K-I-B-B-E-N, or call the ticket office at 816-235-6222. This is a public service announcement of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Pack your bathing suit and your hiking boots for this current cast. Going to the dunes usually means a day at the beach, but the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, which spans 15 miles of Lake Michigan's coastline, is more than sand and waves. Kathy Martin of the nonprofit Save the Dunes says trails wind through a variety of habitats.
If you were to start at the lake, you would walk through to the beach, a foredune, a forested dune, oak savanna habitats, wetlands, and then woodlands.
Oak savannas, once common in the Midwest, are rapidly disappearing.
We have some really high-quality ones here left, so we'd like to say we have the best of the last of some things.
Making the dunes not just a beach, but a biological gem. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
And here we are back on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, Eco Radio KC. And since we took that break, we did get Joe Charest on the line. Joe, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you just fine. Thank you.
All right. So, Joe, we've been talking about the recent Kansas Corporation Commission's ruling on with regard to the injection of wastewater in the Flint Hills from fracking, and I'm not sure if you had much of a chance, if you heard any of the discussion so far, but I just wanted to maybe let you jump in. What is your take on this?
Well, my thing is they have 30 legislators that have written in and expressed their opposition to this. They had testimony that was altered from the pre-hearing testimony to the actual hearing testimony as to how much they were wanting to inject into the ground. They have all of this documentation saying that there are two fault lines, the Humboldt fault line and the Nemaha updrift, and that it's also within 100 miles of a nuclear power plant and close to the Ogallala aquifer. They've had all of this supporting information. Why did they approve the permit for the injection wells? And it makes no sense to me why they decided to do this. And, you know, we've already got earthquakes from fracking-induced activity or fracking activity down in south-central Kansas. Well, the fracking is in Oklahoma, but, you know, I have people in Wichita that tell me all the time that they felt a tremor. Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I heard a beep on my end. I have people telling me all the time that they find feel tremors that last maybe 3 seconds or 3 minutes or, you know, whatever. And, you know, do we want that kind of thing happening up here so close to a nuclear power plant? I mean, look at what happened to Fukushima, Japan, mm-hmm. when they had their big earthquake. And, you know, there's still radioactive isotopes being found in the seawater and the sea ice that have found their way to the shores of the United States, West Coast.
Yeah.
And can you imagine what that's going to do to what that could do to our agricultural ecosystem? I mean, we're the breadbasket of America. I mean, can you imagine saying, oh, hey, welcome to the breadbasket of America. Please try our radioactive wheat and beef, you know? I mean, that's really what it boils down to.
So you mentioned something about altered testimony. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, okay. In their pre-testimony, they had given a figure of, and I don't have anything in front of me, and I apologize, so I may get the figures slightly wrong. I'm not in front of my computer where I can have access to this information. But the first one was like 3,500 or 3,000 or something like that. And then the actual testimony, they wanted approval for 5,000. And so, I mean, there's quite a big difference between 2,300 and 5,000. And so the KCC questioned that. I was in the room when they had that hearing. And they questioned it, and they said, well, we'll have to deliberate this further before we can give a decision today. And so, I mean, the fact that the guy gave such a big discrepancy of what he was wanting approved for should have been a red light. He's already had what was already found in non-compliance of one of his wastewater injection wells. And again, I have that documentation on my computer at home that I would be happy to provide listeners with at a later time if they want me to get that to them. But with that and knowing that he's already been in non-compliance with one wet injection well, how do we know he's not going to be in compliance for this one in future injection wells? So that's another concern that I have. And, you know, really, I just really don't want this in my backyard. I mean, I live in Topeka, Kansas. And Morris County is really not that far from us, if you really think about it. And we're the capital city of Topeka. So I feel like Topekans should be saying something about this. Because Wolf Creek Power Plant's not that far from us. Wolf Creek Power Plant's only about an hour's drive away from Topeka, if that.
So is there a little bit of concern about this in Topeka other than from yourself?
There's a few people that are alarmed about it, yes. But I posted on my Facebook page. I said, you know, what is the city's stance on this? Has anybody from the city weighed in and talked to the KCC about this? And I haven't gotten any response from anybody at a city level who follows me on Facebook.
Okay.
So,
Bob?
I mean, that's kind of concerning.
Right.
There are concerns, again, that weren't even raised in the filing by the protestants having to do with water, and that's the leaking of injection wells. There is a study that just came out recently. I think it was out of Yale, and I need to find that one in six cement casings surrounding these injection wells fail.
Wow.
It's a huge, huge percent. The industry has its own studies that say it's something like 0.015%. Mm. But I would trust a third-party scientific survey. So something not even being addressed is the leaking of this fracked wastewater into our water systems and poisoning our water.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yeah, because, again, the aquifer is right close by to where they're wanting to do this. And do we want to poison our major water supply in Kansas?
Mm.
No, we don't.
Not before
you know,
we finish depleting it.
This, drink water from this. We irrigate our fields from the aquifer.
You guys, I looked up some of this stuff from the sources my friend had sent me on what kind of chemicals are in there. I'll just read off some of them. I mean, again, it's proprietary, but these are typical ones found in fracking wastewater operations. Polyacrylamide, glutaraldehyde, ethylene glycol, isopropanol. That's not that bad. Aluminum phosphate ester oils, organometallic
benzene.
Fluids, Mm-hmm. And that's all I got.
Yeah, benzene.
Benzene.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, we I have a list as well, and it's pretty egregious.
We've just got a minute left, so I just want to make sure we get everything in we need to. Again, the Kansas Water is the name of the Facebook page.
Yeah, I've been aggregating stuff on that site, so it has a lot of information on it if people want to follow what's going on.
Okay, and then the Facebook event you've set up for Thursday's Direct Action is called Quail. What is it called?
Quail oil has no right to our land.
Okay, that's great. And that's taking place on Thursday. And
at 4 o'clock at the KCC offices.
Okay, which is 1500 Southwest Harrowhead in Topeka. And, yeah, I think we're just about out of time because we've got a lot of calendar events to read off. But I want to thank you folks all for joining us this evening and illuminating our listeners and certainly ourselves. So thank you, everybody, for
thank you,
taking
guys.
Part.
Thanks for having
awesome.
Us.
Awesome.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. Take care. All right. We're going to take it over to Natural Lee for the events, and we'll take it from there.
Thank you, Mike. October 4th is Walk to School Day. Students are encouraged to skip the car or bus ride and walk or bike to school for International Walk to School Day on Wednesday, October 4th. Events are planned across the metro to encourage students, schools, and neighborhoods to join the citywide effort. Last year, 94 schools in the metro area participated. Mid-America Regional Council and Bike Walk KC organized this local annual Walk to School Day. You can find more information and to sign up by visiting walktoschoolkc.com. You can meet the environmentalist and author Bill McKibben and hear his insight on the hottest fight in the hottest decade, climate change on the edge of hope and despair, on Friday, October 6th at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. A reception begins at 6 p.m., followed by the lecture at 6:30, and a book signing after the lecture at Pearson Auditorium, which is located at 5000 Holmes Street, right here in Kansas City, Missouri. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required at UMKC. You can find more information by visiting umkc.edu. Indy Energy has arranged for an on-site tour of the Independence Community Solar Farm, which was constructed and operated by MC Power, a Lee's Summit-based company. The original community solar went live this past spring, and Saturday, October 14th, 2017, they will be doing a tour. So you can come and tour their facilities there. It's October 14th at 10 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. at the Community Solar Farm, which is at 24451 East Bunshoe Road. It's opposite Indian Trails Elementary School there in Independence. You can get details about signing up for this community solar through Independence Power and Light. Tickets are free, but the tour is limited to 30 people. We posted more information about that on our Eco Radio Facebook page. You can also go to indieenergy.org. Crisis in Cowtown? Coping with climate change. It's the 16th Annual Environmental Issues Forum from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. on Thursday, October 5th, 2017 at the New Johnson County Arts and Heritage Center, located at 8788 Metcalf. Exhibits are 5:30 to 6:45, and Heartland Conservation Alliance, League of Women Voters, Cultivate KC, and many more will be on site. They'll talk about coping with climate change, and they'll have a panel. Laura Ish from the Kansas City Water Services, Tom Jacobs of MARC, and Lou Jean Marsh. They will explain the human impact of changing climate. We also posted that on our Facebook page. There's a discussion on faith and health hosted at this conversation. The Johnson County Department of Health and Environment will share the results of their community health assessment with the faith community and explain their health improvement plan. That's Thursday, October 26th from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Johnson County Arts and Heritage Center at 8788 Metcalf Avenue. Lawrence folks, they can come out and enjoy the community apple pressing Saturday, October 14th at 11 a.m. Come out and take a turn with the apple press. All are welcome to participate in this free. And then once again, just to mention, Kansas Water is hosting that nonviolent direct action on the grounds of the Kansas Corporation Commission's office Thursday, October 5th at 4 p.m. Go to our Eco Radio Facebook page to find all these events.
The Colorado River sues Colorado. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Recovery operations in Puerto Rico are still running into significant gridlock as of October 1st. The Hill reports that problems persist in moving items such as food, water, medicine, and other critical materials out of the port in San Juan.
People are having to spend up to an entire day just to obtain one necessity like food or fuel. About 20 miles from the capital, locals lined up to fill containers near a PVC pipe that trickles water from a hillside spring, according to USA Today.
Even before the hurricane, however, clean drinking water in Puerto Rico was a major problem. In May, the National Resources Defense Council issued a report concluding that the island suffered the worst rate of drinking water violations of any state or territory in the nation.
Nearly 70% of the water systems had high levels of contaminants, including volatile organic compounds.
Now people are worried that winds and lashing rains from the hurricane may have washed toxins into waterways from coal ash dumps.
Grist reports that the island has 40 toxic dumps of ash from burning coal to generate power. These open-air dumps contain lead, arsenic, and other chemicals that can contaminate sources of drinking water.
If there is any silver lining to this immense disaster, it may be that Puerto Rico could rebuild its water and power generation infrastructure on sustainable and renewable sources.
Environmental laws are failing to protect the environment. That's what some people in Colorado are saying, and they want to change that by treating ecosystems the same way as corporations.
Last week, a lawsuit was filed in Denver claiming that the Colorado River should be accorded the status of a person with rights to exist and to thrive independent of human ownership or use.
The Boulder Weekly reports that the suit is being brought in the name of the river against the state of Colorado, but because the river cannot speak, members of the Deep Green Resistance, an environmental activist group, are listed as guardians or next friends acting on the river's behalf.
The notion that a river has rights of its own may be new in the U.S., but not in other countries. Last week in Australia, the legislature in Victoria passed the Yarra River Protection Act that treats the river as one integrated living natural entity.
And in India, both the Ganges and Yamuna rivers have legal status.
Officials with the state of Colorado have not yet responded to the suit, but those opposed to the rights of nature approach say that it would unravel the current water rights system that has existed for 150 years.
Imagine that 70% of the U.S. demand for electricity could be met by a source that's non-polluting and works whether the sun is shining or the wind is blowing.
A new technology based upon water evaporation could make that a reality, according to a team from Columbia University.
They've developed an evaporation engine which works by using muscle-like bands that expand and contract with tiny changes in humidity. As the bands get wetter, they grow, then shrink as they dry. The energy from the expansion and contraction has been shown to power a light bulb or move a model car.
As reported in Quartz, the scientists have calculated the average rate of evaporation from inland waterways in the U.S. and have projected that it could be a massive source of renewable energy.
Scientists are in awe and a bit fearful as a new study shows that after the 2011 tsunami in Japan, nearly 300 species of marine life crossed the Pacific Ocean and arrived on the west coast from Alaska to California.
The BBC reports that creatures such as mussels, starfish, and many other invertebrates rafted across the ocean, often on pieces of plastic debris.
The tsunami washed things like coolers, fishing boats, and even docks into the sea, and with the living creatures attached, they made a journey of over 6,000 miles.
The research says that the presence of plastic, fiberglass, and other materials that do not decompose made the rafting possible for the animals.
But while the journey of these marine hitchhikers is remarkable, it also raises concerns about the risk of invasive species. As storms become more intense due to climate change, that threat is larger than it's ever been. And finally, last Friday was International Coffee Day, and many chains were offering free cups of Joe to celebrate because we Americans, we love our Java. According to market research firm Euromonitor, Americans drink more coffee than soda, tea, and juice combined.
But is coffee good for you? That answer seems to change as fast as you can say grande half-calf soy no-foam latte. And in fact, there were two stories out this week that complicate whether we should drink up or worry.
First, the good news. A new study of people who drank a minimum of 4 cups a day had a higher chance of living longer compared to folks who rarely drank the stuff. And in case you're wondering, it didn't matter if the coffee were full strength or decaffeinated.
The new finding supports previous research that showed coffee could also reduce the risk of many conditions, including type 2 diabetes, liver disease, colorectal cancer, and Alzheimer's.
Now that bad news. According to the AP, a lawsuit filed in 2010 by the Council for Education and Research on Toxics resumed this week in Los Angeles.
Its primary complaint is that coffee retailers such as Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, Seattle's Best, Whole Foods, and several convenience stores violated the California Safe Drinking Water and Toxic Enforcement Act, also known as Proposition 65. That law requires them to post warnings about chemicals known to cause cancer or that have reproductive toxicity.
The compound at issue is the carcinogen acrylamide that forms in some foods when they're cooked at high temperatures by frying, roasting, or baking. We're talking things ranging from French fries to dark toast and, of course, coffee.
The industry has acknowledged the presence of acrylamide, but asserts it is at harmless levels, which are outweighed by coffee's benefits.
The outcome of the suit that's been brewing for years could determine if there's a wake-up call about to hit the coffee industry. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Water quality experts will present the latest science and research in the field at WQTC in Portland, November 12th through 16th. Learn more at awwa.org/WQTC.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.